Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Trump's threat to go after NBC's FCC license because he does not like the news they are reporting about his own Secretary of State calling him a moron, and now revelations that Trump called for the U.S. nuclear arsenal to be increased tenfold. An historian of science who specializes in the history of nuclear weapons and nuclear secrecy, Alex Wellerstein, professor of science and technology studies at the Stevens Institute of Technology, joins us to discuss how different Trump is from previous presidents who, upon learning of the power they have at their fingertips to destroy the world, felt the weight of enormous responsibility that came with their stewardship of the nuclear arsenal. But unlike his predecessors, who found it a sobering burden, Trump sees nukes as instruments of power to be used, as he has said cavalierly, otherwise, why do we have them? And we'll also look into the sobering truth that there is nothing stopping Trump from unleashing America's arsenal of 7,100 nuclear weapons if he feels like it. Then we will speak with Norman Ornstein, a contributing editor to The Atlantic and the co-author of a new book just out, One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. We will discuss how Trump is both a threat to our democracy and a product of its weaknesses, and look ahead to the challenges we face in fixing our broken democracy so that we don't have more Trumps elected by a minority via the reactionary Electoral College. And because of demographic changes underway from the depopulation of rural red states and the concentration of populations in urban areas, in a few decades, 60% of the U.S. Senate will be elected by 40% of the American population. Then finally, we'll examine the growing tensions between the U.S. and Turkey as Turkey's authoritarian leader becomes more and more unhinged, with his government-controlled press demonizing America to the point where the U.S. is blamed for everything, including earthquakes. A former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the State Department during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama, David Phillips, joins us to discuss how the U.S. and Turkey are on a collision course because of a trial in New York that will expose Erdogan and his family's massive corruption. And joining us now is Alex Wellerstein, who's a professor of science and technology studies at the Stevens Institute of Technology and an historian of science who specializes in the history of nuclear weapons and nuclear secrecy. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Knowledge and the Bomb, Nuclear Secrecy in the United States, 1939 to 2008. And he also has a three-part report at the Nuclear Secrecy blog, The President and the Bomb. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alex Wellerstein.
Thank you very much, Ian. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. And we have, of course, a bit of a tiff going on between NBC News and President Trump. He's calling them fake news and equating them to CNN, who originally had were the exemplars of fake news as far as President Trump's concerned. But it all goes back to a meeting in July in the so-called tank at the secure room in the Pentagon, where a number of senior officers were there, along with Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. And we told earlier that Donald Trump was talking about Afghanistan, and he went into this long analogy about this fancy restaurant in New York called the 21 Club, how they had renovated the 21 Club and spent an awful lot of money. And then at the end of the day, he talked to a waiter who told him all of the money was wasted and they were worse off than they were before they did the renovations. Well, one, it turns out to be completely untrue. The 21 Club said they never did these renovations. So Trump made this entire story up. That was apparently what prompted Secretary of State Tillerson to say after the meeting ended that Trump was an effing moron. But now we're learning that there was another reason, perhaps, why the Secretary of State made that remark, and that was that Donald Trump wanted to nearly increase America's nuclear arsenal tenfold. And nobody seems to know where he got that idea from.
So that's basically my understanding. But what I had read is that he had looked at a chart showing the history of the American nuclear stockpile, which you can find very similar charts online. They've been declassified. And if you look at that kind of chart, you'll see that the position we're in now, and have been for a long time, is a lot fewer nuclear weapons than we had during the Cold War, which shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody. But if your goal is, if you believe that the more nuclear weapons you have, the more powerful you are, you could imagine how somebody would say, why do we have this piddly number of nuclear weapons, if they saw that chart?
Well, we know that Trump at some point earlier also said, why do we have nuclear weapons if we don't use them? And also, when he had his first briefing in the transition, in fact, this was the first briefing he got, was from the State Department, who did a round robin, just letting the new president know about what was happening around the world. And apparently, all Trump wanted to talk about was what would happen if a nuclear weapon hit New York. So there's something strange going on with Donald Trump in terms of nuclear weapons. It almost sounds like he has some peculiar fetish. What's your understanding? Is this just ignorance, or is this something we should be alarmed about?
Well, we should always be alarmed if the head of state of the United States has an ignorance about nuclear weapons, and he wouldn't be the first who did, but that's he has unilateral control over the use of nuclear weapons. So the fact that it is of a piece with even his public statements relating to nuclear weapons that he does not have a lot of understanding of them. He does read them in some crude sense as a form of power, and has somehow missed several decades of discussion on, like, why we don't use nuclear weapons. So the nuclear weapons expert community, who I'm familiar with and know many different types of them, are actually quite alarmed that Trump is probably the first president since, maybe even Harry Truman, who doesn't seem to have a very strong inhibition about nuclear weapons, who doesn't see them as a problem. And so I'm not worried about the 10 times increased for a variety of reasons we can talk about if you want, but there is a theme here, which is Donald Trump doesn't seem to know much about nuclear weapons, and that's actually quite disturbing, both because we live in a world with nuclear weapons in North Korea and all this kind of stuff, and complicated technical things like the Iran deal and all that, but also because we are in the middle of a modernization program. We are in the middle of really key policy discussions people should be having about nuclear weapons that they're not really having, and he doesn't seem to be aware of what's going on.
And again, I'm speaking with Alex Wellerstein, who's a professor of science and technology studies at the Stevens Institute of Technology and an historian of science who specializes in the history of nuclear weapons and nuclear secrecy. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Knowledge and the Bomb, Nuclear Secrecy in the United States, 1939 to 2008. And he also has a three-part report at the Nuclear Secrecy blog, The President and the Bomb. Well, in the interview that Stephen Bannon gave to 60 Minutes, Stephen Bannon made the case, and he sounded rational, when normally he seems like a wild kind of right-wing bomb thrower, but in this case he seemed quite reasonable when he said that, you know, we have this $1 trillion nuclear modernization plan underway. Wouldn't it be better to save $1 trillion and make a deal with the Russians, because it's just a huge waste of money? You certainly can make that case, can you? I mean, what's the point? We've got 7,100 nuclear weapons, and the Russians have got 7,300 or something. We could certainly reduce them, couldn't we?
You can make an argument as a totally rational person and a totally reasonable, peace-loving person that we might need some kind of modernization. And that's just based on the fact that these weapon systems we have are very old. And as age increases, uncertainty increases, and at some point you might have to say, we need more submarines, or we need new ICBMs, or we need a new bomber. And I'm actually quite open to having that discussion. The thing that I find really troubling is the idea that we need to upgrade all three legs of our triad, that we need to sort of at least replace the full arsenal we have, or even have more capabilities. That seems to go beyond what, at least in my mind, is necessary for sort of simple deterrence, which used to be more or less what the United States has said for several decades is our goal with nuclear weapons. We only have them because we don't want them to be used against us, and if we have them, nobody will use them against us. And I don't have a huge problem with that, but I do wonder, I don't know if we can make a deal with Russia to get rid of all nuclear weapons, but I do think it's telling that many states around the world find that they can get by with, say, only submarines, Britain and France in particular, right? More or less. They have a few others that are not just submarines. But I don't think I totally feel, I have not yet feel compelled by all the arguments that we need all of these different systems to feel secure. I sort of wish that we had more of a discussion in this country about what the costs of, say, $1 trillion are, what we don't get because we spend that $1 trillion on weapons that, in theory, nobody will ever use. We could have high-speed rail. We could have a better healthcare system. We could have a social safety net. That sensibility seems to be lost when talking about this stuff. But there may be some need to upgrade things, that we don't have to have it be all or nothing. But I do feel that the existing modernization plan that is on the books is kind of an all plan. It's a pretty expensive plan as far as they go.
Well, you know, subsequent, of course, to the NBC News report of this meeting, not just reporting initially about Rex Tillerson calling Trump an effing moron, which obviously got under Trump's skin, but now the subsequent report from the same meeting that he wanted to increase the nuclear arsenal tenfold because he apparently did look at a chart and seemed to think we had lost our edge. But when you say that you are afraid that he does equate nuclear weapons with power, that's a very different reaction to what happened when Jimmy Carter got his briefing when he first became president, after he got elected. And he, of course, was a nuclear engineer, so he understood nuclear power and presumably had an idea about nuclear weapons. But apparently when they gave him the briefing about the football and the enormous power and responsibility a president has with the arsenal and what the arsenal was capable of, he was so shaken that one of his first speeches was a call for nuclear disarmament. So that's my understanding of our tradition with presidents and nuclear weapons. And we know that Ronald Reagan, even though he seemed very bellicose in his first few years, succeeded in bringing about nuclear arms reduction and bringing an end to the Cold War along with Mikhail Gorbachev. So it does seem that in the response to when presidents learn of the enormous power and responsibility they have with the nuclear arsenal, most of them are very sobered by it. But I don't get the impression that Trump is sobered at all. If anything, it's like raring to go.
It's very troubling. And yeah, most of the accounts we have of presidents learning about these things is about them feeling like this immense burden is put on their shoulder. And there's a wonderful quote I love from John F. Kennedy, where he is given a briefing on one of their war plans, and he turns to one of his assistants and they say, "And we call ourselves the human race," right? We have, you know, the idea that this is just so abhorrent. I think it's really disturbing that Trump has a pretty cavalier approach. He has a pretty loose understanding of the facts. His approach with North Korea seems almost like he's daring them, and that's extremely dangerous. It does not reflect what I think is pretty clear, that, you know, a misstep on the Korean Peninsula could end up with hundreds of thousands of dead either Americans or our allies. That's unacceptable for whatever political gain you might get. It's not clear to me, as somebody who is very far from the circles of power, that this is part of any kind of calculated strategy. I don't think that I'm not sure that Trump has strong actual opinions. I think he sounds like he's going for a good soundbite and sort of revving up his domestic base by, you know, obviously not if he's saying things behind the scenes, but when he's saying them in public. But this can be very dangerous. So I think There's a lot of concern by people who study nuclear weapons and have studied the history of it, who a lot of them are saying, this doesn't feel right. This feels actually pretty dangerous. This feels like some of the more bellicose things Reagan did, and Reagan did turn a corner later in his administration on these issues. But at the beginning, he seemed quite enthusiastic himself for quite a bit. So I don't know. It's very worrying. The only upshot I can tell you is that there's no way that Donald Trump could increase the American nuclear stockpile by 10 times, even if he wanted to. We no longer have the industrial and scientific infrastructure in place to do that. It required about a decade's worth of investment during the Cold War at very high pace of work to build up that infrastructure so that you could churn out lots and lots of nuclear weapons. And we have deconstructed pretty much all of that infrastructure after the end of the Cold War. So as far as the nuclear worries go, him increasing the stockpile by 10 times is really not on the list. It's just not physically possible to do that. But there's a lot of other things he can do as president. So there's plenty of other things to worry about.
Well, but Senator Corker has made it clear that he's worried, and I'm sure other people are worried, and that he's counting on the generals to contain Donald Trump, and he referred to the White House as an adult daycare center, yeah. And that when Trump goes off on a tweeting rant, Corker suggested that one of the adults missed their shift. There is no impediment, of course, between Trump and the nuclear button. If the country were attacked, the early warning system, the warning would go through the Secretary of Defense and the National Security Advisor, so there'd be a chain of command there. But as far as I know, if Trump wakes up on the wrong side of the bed, he could actually order a nuclear strike. Whether it would be carried out or not, I'm not sure. You've studied that mechanism, if that's the right way to describe it. What's your understanding about the football and who has control over it?
Legally and procedurally, if the President of the United States wants to use nuclear weapons, he has the power to do so. And nobody legally or procedurally has any means of stopping that order from going forward other than essentially mutiny or disobey. That's possible. Sometimes people say, and have asked me, well, do you think that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, or who, you know, there's people who, where that order jumps from the president to the actual people who know how the system works and the military side of things, do you think they would carry out an order like that, especially if they thought it was, say, out of the blue or ill-advised? And the answer is, I don't know. From what I can tell, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff seems like a pretty reasonable person with a lot of experience, so that's in his favor. But on the other hand, to hope that the system doesn't work as intended and as it is built to work, I think is extremely optimistic, and I don't think we live in optimistic times. So I would not put a lot of faith in the system not working the way it's designed to work. If it did fail in that way, that would be best for everybody. But I think it requires a lot of optimism. There's a lot of people who have the mistaken impression that the president has to get somebody else, like the Secretary of Defense, to agree with him for the order to be valid. That isn't true. As far as we can tell, me and a number of other people have looked into this quite detailedly. There's a lot that's classified, so maybe there are secret procedures we don't know about. But everything I have found that comes from a sort of official military or high-level source, I've talked to former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry about this, and everything has reinforced this idea that there's no legal or procedural safeguards in place. If something fails and an order was countermanded, that could stop things, but that would require the system basically not to work. So, you know, how optimistic are you? That's, I guess, the question to ask.
Well, but I think this is something that we need to have a national debate on, because, you know, when you have the Republican chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee questioning the competence and stability, which is, a well-chosen word. He could have said sanity. That word, by the way, is being thrown about. I've interviewed a bunch of psychiatrists lately, many of whom think that Trump is troubling, to say the least. Do you think that there's any move anywhere afoot? I know there was a bill put forth by a California Democrat to require Trump to have a psychological evaluation in regarding his access to the nuclear codes. I don't think that's going anywhere. Do you think this is necessary? And what would it take for us to be able to sort of rest easy that not only is there no impediment between the president and the nuclear codes and the ability to destroy the world, which you've made clear that is the case. But if they're accepting that alarming fact, is there anything we can do about assuring ourselves that we have a president who has the mental stability and maturity not to take that step?
The American political system does not have a lot of checks on that sort of thing. There is a 25th Amendment where the cabinet and the vice president can declare a president to be unsound of mind and Congress has to agree. And it's a pretty complicated mechanism. And I don't put a lot of faith in it actually being used. It would be an extraordinary measure. Maybe that'll come up, but that's the kind of thing that no politician is going to want to stick their neck out on that. So I'm pretty dubious. We have a system that is in some ways essentially 18th century, which is to say the founding fathers would have never imagined in 1,000 years that somebody like this would have ever made it through what is meant to be the great safeguard, which is to say elections, the electoral college, all of these kinds of systems, and end up in a position of responsibility and power that is this great. And they didn't even have nuclear weapons. So this is, you add that to the equation, and obviously they couldn't have conceived of this. And our nuclear weapons system was not set up with the idea that the president would be the weak link in the system. It was set up with the idea that the president is going to be the strong link that keeps, say, military forces from blundering into nuclear war or being overly militaristic. And so we have a system that is apparently very poorly set up for our current conditions. My optimism that we will fix the system in situ as it is, right, fix it like now concurrently, is very low. And that's partially because systems tend not to correct themselves in the middle of operation. And also, we live in extraordinarily partisan times, and that's going to make it difficult for anybody to do anything and get cooperation on. People read their party identifications as sort of their main tribal badge and are very hard to convince otherwise. It doesn't mean it's impossible. You know, we have the example of Nixon, for example. But even there, that was Nixon himself eventually agreeing to throw in the towel, not the other things going around. So I'm not that optimistic that we will fix this at the moment. I don't think Congress is going to get its act together on these things. If I was going to be optimistic, and I'm not an optimistic person, but if I was going to be optimistic, I would say maybe we should keep all of this very close in our mind so that when this is over, assuming it is over, assuming it is not over in the worst possible ways it could be over, assuming terrible catastrophes don't happen, that, you know, who knows how that would affect the political situation, assuming we get at the end of this and we can start thinking about what went wrong, what would we fix about our system, I feel like we have a nice laundry list forming of things we would change about how the primary system would work, how the elections themselves ought to be, you know, made more free and easy and accountable, how we should think about foreign intervention. We have a lot of things on there that in a better world we would sit down and try to fix. One of these things I would try to fix is changing the procedures for how nuclear launch orders are made so that you could not have it vested in a single person. And you could have a nice national conversation about how should we set up such a system? Should you have it be two or three people? Should they be civilians or military? Should it be effectively a no first use policy? I don't know what the answer is there, and there's a lot of possible rational ideas that we could discuss, but we need to have this conversation because our system is built for a Cold War situation where the fear is that we're going to get nuked out of the blue and we need to nuke back immediately and we're not going to have any time for real deliberation or discussion. That seems pretty unlikely, hopefully, going forward. But in any case, we don't want a situation where a president could, as you put it, wake up on the wrong side of the bed and decide that they're going to start using nuclear weapons. And if it seemed inconceivable only 5 or 10 years ago that this would ever be the situation, we've clearly found that this is conceivable. And just on my line of optimism and pessimism, I'm not totally convinced that this is the worst it could possibly be. I'm not convinced we've if a system can produce this kind of outcome once, it can produce it again, and it can produce worse. And so this is a nice time for Americans to sit back and think about how to make our democracy more stable and functional going forward. We're not going to be able to implement those plans for a while, if ever, but we need to have that discussion, because someday we might be in the opportunity to actually make some improvements.
Well, Alex Wallerstein, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yes, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And again, I'm speaking with Alex Wallerstein, who is a professor of science and technology studies at the Stevens Institute of Technology and an historian of science who specializes in the history of nuclear weapons and nuclear secrecy. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Knowledge and the Bomb, Nuclear Secrecy in the United States, 1939 to 2008. And he also has a new three-part report at the Nuclear Secrecy blog, The President and the Bomb. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with the co-author of a new book, One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported.
But the atoms here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military datum, like who gets there firstest with the mostest atoms. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta get together or disintegrate. A holeless truth to be self-evident, that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Norman Ornstein, who is a contributing writer for The Atlantic, a contributing editor and columnist for The National Journal, and is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He's the author of numerous books, including the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-authored with Thomas Mann. Now, with an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was. He is the co-author of a new book just out, One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. And he has an article at The Atlantic, American Kakistocracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Norman Ornstein.
Thanks, Ian. Always good to be with you.
Well, thank you, Norman. And it's difficult to know where to begin. Talk about kakistocracy, yeah, or one nation after Trump. At least the implication is that something's going to survive Trump. But let's start with kakistocracy, the Greek word for what? Government by the worst possible people? Is that
government by the worst and most unscrupulous people? And, of course, it comes from the Greek. It was a term that comes from the 17th century, according to the etymology, and it fell into disuse for a long time. But now I have written that it applies quite well to where we are.
Well, it's an amazing how brazen the Trump family are, particularly Jared Kushner, who may well be in trouble, but my understanding from some intelligence sources I've talked to, specializing in the Middle East, that not only has Jared Kushner formed a relationship of sorts with the boy king of Saudi Arabia, MBS, his wife got $100 million from MBS for her foundation. And I'm told that Jared Kushner then went to shake down the Qataris and basically said, if you don't give me a few hundred million for my building that's underwater at 666 Fifth Avenue, me and the Saudis will put the squeeze on you, which is what they subsequently did. If any of this is true, I mean, this is an amazing change in American foreign policy, where a private family are using the full weight of America to not just enrich themselves, but to sort of almost like USA incorporators have been turned into a protection racket.
Exactly so. And, you know, beyond the term kakistocracy, we need the terms kleptocracy and autocracy. But one thing certainly about the potential, or at least the alleged shakedown of the banking interests, where we know that the family has a $1.2 billion balloon mortgage on this building coming due, and they don't have the cash to pay for it. The framers, when they put the Foreign Emoluments Clause in the Constitution, were very much aware of two possibilities. One, of course, was that foreign interests, foreign government interests especially, could use their resources to bribe American officials to act in ways that would not meet America's national interest. The other was, and this is the same phenomenon we see with campaign finance laws, that people with power in and around the government could affect foreign policy and also America's interests by shaking down others with the threat of the use of American power. And we've seen potential abuses here on a whole range of fronts. We've seen some foreign entities like the Chinese effectively trying to bribe the president and his family by giving trademarks to the president and other things that benefited the family Ivanka's own interests with her factories abroad. And, you know, all of this is troubling, to say the least. And, of course, we also know that Jared Kushner, after the election, before the inauguration, met with Russian interests that appeared to be banking interests, and very likely was talking with them about getting money to pay off this mortgage. And heaven knows what other kinds of relationships have been there with Russians.
Well, this feels, though, that we have a government, a tyranny of the minority. And I find it very paradoxical and very puzzling, Norman Ornstein, that as Trump's numbers go down and his support base shrinks to now something around 32%, now, admittedly, about 80% of Republicans still support him and believe what he says and what Fox and Breitbart and right-wing talk radio say about him, and they believe the rest of it, the mainstream media purveyors of fake news. So he's created those, effectively created those two alternative universes. But as he gets less popular, he throws the full weight of the government behind the wish list of the far right and of religious fundamentalists in this country. So as he gets less popular, all the goodies are going to this shrinking fringe of American politics. So what does it say about the majority in this country? How did we end up in a system of the tyranny of the minority?
Well, we have a couple of factors here that we have to take into account. There's the structural one, there's the behavioral one. Let me just start with the behavioral one. It's been clear from the beginning, from the campaign that Trump ran, from the kind of presidency that he's had, that his focus has been continually on not broadening his base, but narrowing his base and focusing on shoring up and also getting roused up that 30 to 35% who are with him no matter what of the entire electorate. That also happens to be probably 60% of the activist base that turn out in primaries for Republican members of the House and Senate, and they're plenty intimidated by that. What we've seen in the last week, I think, is that some portion of that base has been shrinking. He's lost some support in southern states, even in Tennessee, Mississippi, Alabama. His support among Republicans has declined by 20% or so. It's still well over 50%. But as he's seen that base erode, he's doubled down on trying to win them back with more extreme actions and views. And that includes the hardest line that we have seen yet in immigration, after he was getting very close, presumably, to a deal on the Dreamers, DACA, as we call it, with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. He came out with a set of plans that included funding the wall and many other tough immigration plans before he'd do a deal with the Dreamers, snatched that negotiation off the table effectively. He's taken a much harder line stance on health care, moving very, very directly to sabotage the Affordable Care Act, and of course, doing a tremendous blow to contraception, and that will mollify many in his evangelical right. And his actions on the NFL are also designed to whip up that particular base. Now, that's the behavioral side. The structural side, which is something we write about a lot in the book, is the fact that our country has changed very substantially since the framers set a system in place. The Electoral College doesn't work. It doesn't work at all the way it was originally intended, which is a group of solid opinion leaders, citizens, would filter candidates and make sure we didn't end up with somebody completely unsuited to the office. But what we've seen now is that we've gone from a situation where the ratio between the smallest and largest states, with this role that's there for every state, no matter how small, has gone from 13 to 1 to 70 to 1. We went for 100-plus years through 44 elections, almost 200 years, when the popular vote first began to matter in 1824, all the way through 1996, with arguably only one election where it was clearly the case that the president won the electoral vote without the popular vote. And now we've had two out of the last five, and we're likely to have more. The Electoral College is tilting increasingly towards small, rural, homogeneous, and mostly white states, and we have a crisis of legitimacy there. At the same time, the Senate is moving into really dangerous territory. By 2050 or earlier, 70% of Americans will live in 15 states. That means that 30% of Americans will have 70% of the senators. And, of course, the House is dramatically affected, not just by natural residential patterns, but by gerrymandering that accounts for probably two-thirds of their majority in the House of Representatives. And if that's the kind of political system that we have, we don't have a democracy. We have a Republican form of democracy, small r, but the people are supposed to matter. And if a majority doesn't matter, what kind of legitimacy can you have? It's a real problem, and it's why doubling down on a smaller base and then having voter suppression to try and reduce the votes of those who don't support you as an alternative to trying to appeal to a majority of Americans might work politically for now, but the cost to the system is immense.
And again, I'm speaking with Norman Ornstein, a contributing writer to The Atlantic, a contributing editor and columnist for The National Journal, and a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. His latest book is One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported, co-authored with E.J. Dionne and Thomas Mann, and he has an article at The Atlantic, American Kakistocracy. So the book makes it clear that Trump is both a threat to our democracy and a product of its weaknesses. But you also, again, One Nation After Trump, meaning that somehow we're going to survive this moment, unless, of course, something happens with the nuclear button. And I was speaking yesterday to the former head of the Nixon Library about comparison, basically prompted by what the chairman of the Republican chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee said about raising questions, which clearly indicate Senator Caucus has a deep disquiet about Trump's access to the nuclear codes. And in the Cold War, our job was to contain the Soviet Union. Now it seems the job of our military is to contain the president of the United States. It's like a reversal of that movie, 7 Days in May, when a group of right-wing generals hatched a coup against what they thought was a weak president. Now it's like we're relying on these generals to save us from a mad president with the ability to blow up the world. So I bring that up as a major caveat in terms of One Nation After Trump.
Yeah. Well, you know, our book is hopeful at the end that basically Trump could provide the kind of jolt to the system that will help us in a couple of ways. One is alert us before it's too late about the deep, deep divisions that have been building in the society, including the yawning economic inequality that could have gotten even more out of control without understanding what a danger it represents to the fundamental fabric of a society. The second, of course, is the danger that Trump himself represents, the autocracy, the kleptocracy, and the disastrous government that we call kakistocracy. So we're a little hopeful in that sense. But, of course, when you have a president who is unlike any other. And, you know, the first sentence of our book is that the American political system was not designed to have a president like Donald Trump. There's an assumption that we have enough filters and a system that works well enough that presidents may have a wide range in their values, in their personalities, in their qualities, but they're all going to operate within a certain set of bounds of behavior. And we give those presidents a lot of power, including the power in the modern age, over the nuclear button. Nobody can countermand the president in the end. And when you have somebody as reckless as Trump, out of control, operating on emotion, narcissistic, with communicating by tweet, creating a confrontation with North Korea, among other things, that even if you don't deliberately call for a nuclear strike, you can have a miscommunication or an escalation of words that leads to a mistake that can lead us into disaster. We've got the same sort of thing emerging now with potentially with Iran. And under those circumstances, it's not surprising, perhaps, that the people who are closest to him, who see him operating, who hear his lack of knowledge of what's going on in the world and see the dysfunction, that you have General Mattis, Secretary Tillerson, and General Kelly, former General Kelly as well, all talking about how they might have to gang tackle him to keep him from going to that nuclear football. So that's, of course, the kind of threat right now that may supersede the larger threat to the fabric of our democracy that we've seen heightened again. You know, we see it every day, but the threat to take away NBC's license because he doesn't like what they're saying, a president saying that it makes him, he's frankly disgusted that news outlets can report whatever they want. In other words, he's disgusted with the First Amendment and the Constitution, that he's called the press enemy of the people, that he's challenged judges. All of those things that are sliding steps towards autocracy, a fundamental danger, but, you know, avoiding a war is kind of takes precedence.
Well, in the book, as you mentioned, Norman Ornstein, there are a number of solutions you're offering up to get us out of this mess that we're in, assuming we survive Trump. And the Electoral College you mentioned, of course, there is this simple mechanism, the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. And of course, a constitutional amendment is a very high bar and difficult to achieve. This is a very simple end run around it. And also the Supreme Court has taken up the gerrymandering issue. And yes, everybody's now basically relying on one justice, Kennedy, to be fair.
Yeah.
We've written off Roberts and the new guy, Gorsuch. They're just, it's extraordinary how partisan they are and how they seem to be agents of enabling a minority party to maintain a majority through voter suppression and unlimited money from plutocrats who don't have to tip their hand or expose their influence. So this is really, at the end of the day, a call to a kind of shrinking minority in the middle of the Republican Party, the moderates, Republicans, to do the right thing. Is that the thin reed upon which our country rests?
Certainly, in the end, many of the critical elements that will either keep us with the political system we've had since fundamentally 1789, or to see it slide into something unrecognizable, will depend on the independence of the courts, because we certainly aren't seeing much that's coming from an independent Congress, to say the least. Neil Gorsuch is, at this point, probably the most ideologically rigid of the Supreme Court justices. And given that we have Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas, boy, is that saying something. And it's possible, at least, that on some of these tough decisions affecting the fundamental freedoms, that Chief Justice Roberts will be cognizant of his own reputation and of the system. It's possible. You're right, certainly in many areas, and certainly based on what we saw from the oral arguments in the redistricting case, we don't have much hope in, when it comes to political reforms there. But with Kennedy, at least on that front, it's a little bit more promising. Now, you know, having said that, what happens if sometime down the road, obviously a hypothetical, you would think it would be ridiculous, but not out of the question. What if Donald Trump decides to pardon everybody, including himself? That's going to go to the Supreme Court. We may well have a case that becomes the parallel one to the Nixon tapes case, when we did see the rule of law prevail and a unanimous decision by the court that the president couldn't destroy the tapes. And we're going to have a gut check for some of these justices, Kennedy, certainly, and with that one, if it happens, Roberts as well.
I thank you very much for joining us here today, Norman Ornstein.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you, Ian.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I really appreciate your
time. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Norman Ornstein, who's a contributing writer to The Atlantic and a contributing editor and columnist for the National Journal and a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He's the author of numerous books, including the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-authored with Thomas Mann. Now, in an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was. He's the co-author of a new book just out, One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported, and has an article at The Atlantic, American Kakistocracy. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how Turkey's authoritarian leader Erdogan is getting crazier and crazier. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University, and the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the U.S. Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his latest book is Uncertain Ally, Turkey Under Erdogan's Dictatorship. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Spirit of the Nuclear Deal is a Two-Way Street. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you, Ian.
And I want to get to the article about the nuclear deal that Donald Trump's about to decertify at any moment with Iran. But we talked a lot about Turkey, and of course your book, Uncertain Ally, Turkey Under Erdogan's Dictatorship, was an early warning on what's happening. But it's getting worse. This visa tit-for-tat could escalate, and Erdogan has a propensity to double down. The only person who seemed to be able to sort of trump him, if I could use that phrase, was Putin, who really slapped him hard. Trump himself, of course, bends over backwards to be nice to Erdogan and praised him unctuously in his last visit to Washington, in spite of the fact that Erdogan's bodyguards acted as thugs and beat up American citizens. What do you expect is going to happen here? Because it seems to me that if you read the Turkish press, the vilification of America is just so amazing that is going on where the mayor of Ankara is blaming America for causing earthquakes.
Erdogan has really become unhinged. He's just driven his car into a ditch, and it's having a huge impact on U.S.-Turkish relations. The rhetoric and the optics are terrible, but on substance, the U.S. isn't doing anything that Erdogan has demanded of Washington. We're continuing to support the Kurds in Syria. We're refusing to hand over Fethullah Gulen and to comply with Turkey's extradition request. And coming up soon is the trial of Reza Zarrab, a close Erdogan confidant who's accused of money laundering and helping Iran violate sanctions. Zarab has a lot of dirt on Erdogan, and all that is going to come out in a court of law.
And that's got Erdogan apoplectic, doesn't it?
His behavior is largely in response to his dismay that the U.S. is continuing to put pressure on him. We've brought charges against 15 members of his personal security detail for beating up peaceful pro-democracy demonstrators outside the Turkish ambassador's residence in May. So Erdogan is blowing a lot of hot air. He's created a crisis in U.S.-Turkish relations. He's threatened to throw Ambassador John Bass out of the country without any farewell or ceremony. And there are real implications to this. If Americans are not able to get visas to visit Turkey, if Turks can't visit the United States, that's the first step in a major disruption in the U.S.-Turkey relationship.
Well, in the recent referendum in the north of Iraq, the Kurdish region of northern Iraq, where they had an overwhelming vote for statehood, and obviously the government in Baghdad opposed it. But Turkey was quite threatening, and unusually, the Iraqi military and the Turkish military did exercises right on the border of Iraqi Kurdistan. So there's a lot of mischief that Erdogan can inflict on Kurdistan.
Mischief is a good word. In my view, he's just blowing hot air. Turkey's not going to invade Iraqi Kurdistan, neither is the government of Iraq. They may close the airspace so that flights can't go to Iraqi Kurdistan. But frankly, Erdogan's son-in-law has so many energy interests, and Iraqi Kurdistan supplies 550,000 barrels of oil every day that's transported through Turkey. Money's the bottom line here. Erdogan and his criminal gang is not going to disrupt that.
In terms of the nuclear deal, which Trump is going to decertify at any moment and kick back to the Congress, what's your reading on how that's likely to go? Because, you know, we've had the Republican chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee go public with his disquiet about Donald Trump's presidency. And it's actually quite alarming what he says. And it's also quite disgusting that his fellow Republicans who say things in private where they agree with Corker but won't speak out in public. I guess that's another matter to discuss. But in short, what's your sense of how the chips are going to fall, David Phillips?
Well, firstly, Corker has called Trump unstable. Rex Tillerson has called him a moron. So it looks as though an increasing number of Republicans are starting to look at Donald Trump and wonder what kind of infantile is occupying the White House. As far as the Iran nuclear deal goes, the International Atomic Agency has performed 8 inspections. It's determined that Iran is in compliance with the technical obligations under the Iran nuclear deal. When I say the spirit of the deal is a two-way street, in the short term, Iran gets sanctions relief and money that was frozen in international banks in exchange for stopping its centrifuges, giving up its enriched uranium, shutting down its heavy water enrichment facility at Iraq. That has all been done. But the deal inherently is a bet. It lasts for 10 to 15 years, and the bet is that during that time, Iran is going to be transformed because of its integration economically and politically into the international system. And that because it's transformed, it won't want to resume its nuclear enrichment activities or cross the nuclear threshold. Now, you can debate the merits of the deal, whether or not the Obama negotiators made a right decision. But what's clear, Trump's bombast and rhetoric, which is threatening Iran, emboldens hardliners in Tehran, and makes it increasingly unlikely that the end of the deal, 10 or 15 years down the road, they're not going to look to the United States as a partner with goodwill. They'll revert to their great Satan language and are more likely than not to restart their nuclear program. Iran has broken trust, so has the United States. The long-term gamble that the deal is going to bring the two countries closer together seems to be irreparably damaged.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, David Phillips, my understanding is that Trump's likely to slap sanctions on the Revolutionary Guard Corps and categorize them as a terrorist organization. And they're the Praetorian Guard of the Supreme Leader, and his son, who I think would like to succeed the Supreme Leader, is very close to the IRGC. They're a horrible bunch of people, no doubt about it. But picking a fight with them would seem to me to be a great way to blow up the deal.
It looks as though Trump wants to blow up the deal if he declares them a foreign terrorist organization because of their support for Hezbollah or because of their development of ballistic missile technologies. Then we've walked right up to the brink, and there's no walking back. So clearly Trump is trying to precipitate a crisis. But I do want to make one important point here, Ian. We talked before about what was happening in Iraqi Kurdistan. The government in Baghdad is entirely backed by Iran. So on the one hand, we're confronting Iran and threatening to list the IRGC as a foreign terrorist organization. On the other hand, we're backing Baghdad, which is just a proxy for the Iranian government, instead of the Iraqi Kurds, who have been our allies and who went to battle to help defeat the Islamic State. There's something entirely incoherent about the way that policy is being made. It's not even ideological. It's just not based in reality.
But that goes back a long way, doesn't it, David Phillips? Because essentially, under George W. Bush, the United States got rid of Iran's two problems on either side of it. On its eastern border, it got rid of the Taliban through the invasion after 9/11. And on the western border, it handed Iraq to Iran by that ill-fated, boneheaded, and disastrous U.S. invasion.
So you're absolutely right, but the Bush administration was predictable because of its neoconservative ideology. And ultimately, it wasn't making decisions based on the U.S. national interests. It was making decisions based on an ideology to try to recreate the Middle East and transform these countries into democracies. That was a completely delusional and far-fetched notion. But ideology at least is more predictable. With the Trump administration, there's nothing predictable about its foreign policy, except that he's going to try to pick a fight, and the implications to picking a fight can be very serious. That's why Senator Bob Corker went on the record to warn about World War III, because the implications to Trump's incoherent and erratic policies are potentially disastrous for the United States and for humankind.
Well, David Phillips, on that note, I thank you very much for joining us here today. It's a daily nightmare, but as much as the truth hurts, it's necessary.
Well, thanks for asking me these questions. You know, it's time for some truth-telling.
And again, I've been speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University. He is a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his latest book is Uncertain Ally, Turkey Under Erdogan's Dictatorship. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Spirit of the Nuclear Deal is a Two-Way Street. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.